If you clenched your right hand in a fist, that would be my San Francisco knocking on the Golden Gate. Your little finger would be sunny downtown on the bay, and your thumb would be our ocean beach out on the blue Pacific. They called it the sunset. That's where we lived, with our son, in an old property set like a rough stone among the thousands of new houses put up for returning soldiers and their families, in a part of the city no one really built on until the war was over. Then hills were flattened, soil was laid down over the sand, and they built a grid of streets and low pastel houses with garages and Spanish roofs and picture windows that flashed with the appearance of the sun, all in rows for 50 avenues until you reached the ocean. It felt outside of everything. Once the Chronicle published a map of nuclear damage to San Francisco if it were hit with rings of rubble and fire. The sunset was the only district to survive. When we first moved in, there were so many empty lots that sand always glittered in the air, and it could bury a vegetable garden overnight. Above the sound of the ocean, one could sometimes hear the early morning roar of the lions in the nearby zoo. It was nothing like the rest of the city. No hills or views or bohemians. Nothing Italian or Victorian to make you take a photograph. A new way to live, separated from downtown by more than just a mountain with one tunnel. It sat on the very edge of the continent, with fog so dense and silver you hardly ever saw a sunset in the sunset. Any glowing light was often just a streetcar, emerging like a miner from that tunnel, making its satisfied way out to the ocean. It was a Saturday. It was 1953, and weeks before, we had all watched on television as President Eisenhower and Richard Nixon were sworn in as the first government we could remember neither to be led nor haunted by FDR. We watched that inauguration, full of worries about the Korean War, race issues, the Rosenbergs, the communists hidden everywhere around us, the Russian bombs being prepared and inscribed like voodoo charms with our names, Pearly, Holland, Sunny. We watched and told ourselves, help is coming. People have an idea about the 50s. They talk about poodle skirts and bus strikes and Elvis. They talk about a young nation, an innocent nation. I don't know why they have it so wrong. It must be the consolidation of memory, because all that came later as the country changed. In 1953, nothing had changed. We were still so haunted by the war. Fluoridation seemed like a horrible new invention, and the Woolworths on Market a beautiful one. In those days, the firemen still wore leather helmets. William Platt, the seltzer boy, still left fizzing bottles on our doorstep, waking me with the ring of glass on concrete. The milkman still drove his old-fashioned wagon with gold script on the side, speckles rustle. And impossible as it seems, the iceman still pulled blocks out with his medieval tongs, like a dentist doing an extraction on a whale, making his rounds for those last households without a refrigerator. The rag man and the knife man, the fruit truck and the coal truck and the dry cleaners, the fish man and the colonial bread man and the egg lady all came down the street with their echoing cries of rags, bottles, trash, and grind your scissors, grind your knives, a sound that's gone forever. No one had ever heard anything wilder than a big band, or seen a man grow his hair longer than his ears. We were still trying to figure out how to live in a war after a war. It was a medieval time for mothers. When he was 3, my boy, Sonny, was playing with his loving father in the backyard when I heard shouting. I came running to find my son collapsed in the bower vine. My husband picked him up, rocking him in his arms, hushing his frightened boy, telling me to call the doctor. In those days, they had no idea what caused polio or what to do. The doctor told me it was brought on by summer. A magical diagnosis for a city without a summer. His treatment was leg splints, bed rest, and hot towels, which I applied carefully. And our only other solace was church services, where weeping mothers held up photographs of children. It wasn't a time of freshness and freedom. It was a time of dread. The war was easy compared to this. It's a wonder We didn't run screaming into the streets and set fire to one another's houses. Instead, we hid our fears. Just as my mother hid a lock of her dead brother's hair in the throat of her high-collared Sunday dress, in a pocket she had sewn there. You cannot go around in grief and panic every day. People will not let you. They will coax you with tea and tell you to move on, bake cakes and paint walls. You can hardly blame them. After all, we learned long ago that the world would fall apart, and the cities would be left to the animals and the clambering vines if grief, like a mad king, were allowed to ascend the throne. So what you do is you let them coax you. You bake the cake and paint the wall and smile. You buy a new freezer, as if you now had a plan for the future. And secretly, in the early morning, you sew a pocket in your skin at the hollow of your throat, so that every time you smile or nod your head at a teacher meeting or bend over to pick up a fallen spoon, it presses and pricks and stings, and you know you've not moved on. You never even planned to. It is equal to living in a tragic land, a poet once wrote, to live in tragic times.